We're going to race through the whole of ethics for 2 hours in the morning. This is a new format, sort of an interesting one. And then in the afternoon we can relax and have the two particular very topical questions discussed, presented, and then discussed. It's very interesting to see how this format goes, and it's up to, I think, all of us to help make it a success. Tom Fisher has organised today's event, this Members' Day, and has greatly recruited four other people to help him present the topics on why it should be good. And Tom's going to be the first speaker. I'll say no more. Hand over to you, Tom.
Thank you very much. If anyone hasn't got a handout, there's one or two copies here. Okay, thank you.
Who has got a handout?
There are two handouts going around. One is for school, and the other is a list of participants and programs.
Good morning, everyone. Good morning. Everyone here. Thank you all for coming. Why should we be good? I'm going to answer this question from a utilitarian point of view in two ways. First, why should we adopt the utilitarian view of what is good? And secondly, why should we be good at all? So what is the utilitarian view of what is good? Let's go back to Mill. Mill says, actions are right in proportion as they tend to promote happiness, wrong as they tend to promote the reverse of happiness. By happiness is intended pleasure and the absence of pain. Okay, so I'm going to give some clarification and a bit more detail on that. First of all, utilitarianism is concerned with actions, not motivations or internal thought processes. Secondly, utilitarianism is concerned with consequences. So to evaluate what to do, we need to forecast the all-round consequences. Utilitarians differ over what exactly we're trying to maximise. For Mill and Bentham, it is happiness. Mill believes that the higher pleasures, like doing philosophy, produce more happiness, whereas for Bentham, happiness is simply the greatest surplus of pleasure over pain. R.M. Hare goes for preferences, whilst Peter Singer goes for interests. And I haven't time today to debate the relative merits of these, but I will be happy to answer questions about them. We can also discuss whose happiness we're trying to maximise. For Mill, it was human beings alone, but modern utilitarians, including me, will want to include animals in the calculations. And perhaps we can discuss animal welfare issues this afternoon. Utilitarians distinguish between act utilitarianism and rule utilitarianism. Under act utilitarianism, we assess the pros and cons of each individual action, whereas under rule utilitarianism, we draw up general principles or rules such as telling the truth, being kind, not harming anyone, which in general we believe maximise happiness. We could debate the respective merits of act and rule utilitarianism for a whole day, but we don't have time now. Again, I'll be happy to handle questions. So there's a little bit more flesh on the bare bones of utilitarianism. Why do I think this is a good approach? For me, the main point is that it puts thinking, rationality, at the heart of moral decision making. We can take a utilitarian approach in any conceivable situation and in any culture. Contrast that with systems which rely on intuitions or gut feelings. In this room, I suspect most of us share a similar range of intuitions on moral issues, though there will be differences. But I guess no one here thinks human sacrifice is a morally praiseworthy action, but a member of a primitive tribe might have a different view. More obviously, we find slavery or the subjugation of women unacceptable, but this was once the norm. Perhaps future generations will come to see some of our moral beliefs as barbaric. So in these cases, how can we say that my intuitions are better than yours, that modern Western civilization has better moral values than those of the ancient world? We can't. We are reduced to relativism, the view that no one moral principle is objectively better than any other. Now, you may say that in preferring an approach based on rational thinking, that itself is a kind of intuition. Why should rationality necessarily be an advantage? I'm not sure I can answer that, except to say that if we deny the value of thinking, we should stop doing philosophy itself right away. Okay, so I've explained the main reason why I like utilitarianism as a moral system, and I'm now going to look at the key arguments against it. The first one is a well-known objection called the sacrifice of the innocents, and this can be expressed in a number of ways. One example that I'm going to give is where there are six people on a desert island and they decide that they want to pick on one of their number, let's call him Tom, and treat him as a slave. So it is claimed happiness is maximised because five people are happy and only one is not. Does utilitarianism require us to recommend this course of action? No, I don't think so. First of all, the rule utilitarian has no difficulty with this scenario. They will simply say that there's a general principle or rule not to enslave. Equally, if you believe in the universalizable nature of modern moral language, particularly words like ought and right, you will have no problem. According to this, if you say it is right in situation S to enslave Tom, you have to be also able to say that if I am in Tom's situation, in his shoes, it is right for me to be enslaved in situation S. But we won't say this, so we ought not to enslave Tom. And I'm going to say a little bit more about universalizable moral language later. But even for the apt utilitarian, who doubts the universalizable nature of moral language, I still think it's far from easy actually to specify precisely a situation in which the huge suffering, in my example, inflicted on the slave will be outweighed by the pleasure of the masters. So I don't think the sacrifice of the innocents problem has dealt a critical blow to utilitarianism. The second argument against utilitarianism I'm going to look at is called the impossible burden, or I'm calling it the impossible burden. And this is a problem which has always bothered me about utilitarianism. If I ought to be maximising happiness, I ought to be doing that not just when I'm faced with a moral dilemma, whether to save a drowning child, let's say, or when I do something like make a promise, but I ought to be doing it all the time. living the moral life surely isn't a part-time activity. So I reckon that right now, the action which would produce the greatest happiness is for me to stop this talk. That would be popular, wouldn't it? Phone my bank and get them to transfer all my wealth, let's say, to Oxfam. Because by doing that, I'll help keep more people alive, and morally I ought to act at the very earliest opportunity. Right now. But will I do it? No. I believe I ought to do it, and you probably ought to do it too. But I'm not going to. So by continuing my talk, surely I'm acting wrongly. Now this seems so demanding that no balanced person will be a utilitarian. Life will be just lived in a constant state of guilt. Well, I've said this problem has bothered me for ages, and now I think I've got the answer, which is hinted at by Mill himself. Let me take you back to the original definition of utilitarianism, which says actions are right in proportion as they tend to promote happiness. In other words, we should view rightness and wrongness on a scale and not as absolutes. So at the very pinnacle of rightness is stopping this talk right now and giving my wealth to charity. But not doing that, but perhaps increasing the size of my direct debits, is clearly better than doing nothing. This idea of a relative scale, as well as getting over the hurdle of the impossible burden, also deals with the related issue of what is known in the trades of in the trade as acts of supererogation, actions over and beyond the call of duty. The classic example being Captain Oates' decision on Scott's Antarctic expedition to go for a walk in the snow. So that's all I want to say about the impossible burden. Third objection is, do the ends justify the means? This is one of the commonest objections to utilitarianism. Opponents say that under utilitarianism, the ends justify the means. So it's okay to lie or kill if that action produces better consequences. To this, my answer is yes. It is okay to lie to a Nazi to prevent them from finding a Jewish child. Yes, sometimes you need to break a promise. Yes, sometimes you need to kill someone, whether it's a crazed gunman in a dumbling school classroom or at a state level to stop an invading force. I'm not, of course, saying that these types of actions are always right, just that on occasion they can be. But if you think you need to do these things, you have to take into account the long-term consequences, the impact on the general principle of truth-telling, the growing level of state-induced violence, and so on. Because if lying, let's say, is widespread, then nobody is believed and society itself breaks down. So this brings us neatly to the fourth objection. Are the consequences too difficult to calculate? Joel Marx in Philosophy Now calls this the Achilles heel of any consequentialist theory of ethics, arguing that calculating the net long-term consequences of anything is virtually impossible. And it certainly is difficult. To take the lying example, we need to weigh up the short-term moral benefit which the lie might produce, like concealing some bad news from my dying mother, from the overall impact which that one single lie might have on the credibility of the institution of truth-telling. Nor can we say that if it's too difficult to calculate the consequences, we may substitute a sub-goal such as equality rather than happiness. But then it is not happiness but equality which becomes our key judging criterion. I agree calculating net happiness is complex, but I'm saying two things. First, because it's difficult doesn't invalidate the argument. The argument would only be invalidated if in principle we could never calculate the consequences. And secondly, I want to turn this objection round and ask, can we really make moral choices and not consider the consequences? That seems inconceivable. consequences clearly must have at least some role to play in helping us to make moral choices. Let us hope that future philosophical modelling techniques will help to make that process easier. And here I just want to refer to the work by Richard Layard and others who have shown that happiness, or rather perceived happiness, can be measured in a consistent way over time. Perhaps we can now model different moral choices using these happiness measurements. So I'm going to answer my first question now, that we should adopt the utilitarian view of what is good, because utilitarianism enables us to make informed moral choices based on rational thought. There are difficulties to be overcome, but they are not insuperable. And now to our second question, why should we act in a moral way at all? I want to examine three unsuccessful answers. Mill's own proof of utility, the argument based on universal prescriptivism, and an argument based on enlightened self-interest. Mill had this notoriously bad argument to prove the principle of utility. He said, just as the proof that something is visible is that it can be seen, and that something is audible is that it can be heard, so the proof that happiness is desirable is that it is in fact desired. This is a poor argument which plays on the fact that desirable has evaluative force. Happiness is desirable means happiness ought to be desired, whereas the church spire is visible means that it is seen. It's purely descriptive in force. For a utilitarian like R.M. Hare, the answer to this question is easy. We've already seen how moral judgments are universalizable. If I say, I ought to give all my wealth to charity, then so ought you in the similar relevant circumstances. Equally, if I say that it is right to torture a person in order to extract useful information, then I must also accept that if I were the person holding that information, I ought to be tortured. So moral judgments are universal, something I suspect most of us may agree about. But Hare goes further. For him, moral judgments are also prescriptive. That means that if I say I ought to give all my wealth to charity, and if I really mean it, then logically, if I can do it, I must do it. Ought implies the imperative. So for Hare, the answer to the question, why should we be good, is that if we really believe what we ought to do, and there is no physical constraint, then we're behaving illogically if we don't. What do you think of Hare's argument? Well, I've read Hare closely on this, and I also once had the chance to discuss it with him personally, but I still don't think ought to implies an imperative. If I say, I know I ought to give all my wealth to charity, but I'm not going to, I don't think I'm being illogical, and I don't think I'm necessarily being insincere about my moral duty. So the third question, the third line of argument, is should we be good out of enlightened self-interest? In dealing with bad actions, this may well be true. If I committed some awful crime and seem to have got away with it, I'll have to live with this forever, and I doubt if I can ever be happy. Crime will not pay. But consider now good actions. If I act morally so as to maximise happiness, will I in fact be happier? Certainly it's nice to feel good about ourselves. Perhaps we can find happiness from doing good. And we do feel good if we do a kind deed, and that sort of good feeling can't be obtained any other way. But being good doesn't always result in greater happiness. I might be late to meet a friend, break a promise to meet them at 6 o'clock prompt, knowing they're getting soaked, because I stayed longer to help at the Salvation Army soup kitchen. Arguably, I maximised the general good by doing this, but I made myself feel bad for being late for an appointment. Again, if I acted in the morally perfect way I described earlier, and gave all my money to charity, leaving me and my family in need, would I be happy? Somehow I rather doubt it. So I've examined three unsuccessful answers. What is my answer? For me, the answer to this question lies with Mill himself. Mill states that there is a powerful natural sentiment which, quotes, when once the general happiness is recognised as the ethical standard, will constitute the strength of the utilitarian morality. This firm foundation is that of the social feelings of mankind, the desire to be in unity with our fellow creatures. The social state is at once so natural, so necessary, and so habitual to man, that he never conceives himself otherwise than as a member of a body. So at the end of the quote, so we feel a duty to be good in utilitarian terms just because we are responsible and participating members of society. Or as John Donne said more elegantly, no man is an island. And that in a nutshell is my answer to the question, why should we be good? Thank you. Right, I think we've got 10 minutes. Are you going to do the questions, right?
Okay,
yeah.
Fine.
Yeah. We haven't been very strictly to time, so we have now got 7 minutes for questions.
Make it
so,
fun. Yeah.
Fine.
Yes, when you were discussing the sacrifice of the innocent, it seemed to me that to get utilitarianism out of the hole it digs itself into, you seem to be helping yourself to a kind of Kantian thought, whether at the basis the action is right or wrong. But utilitarianism is supposed to generate the answer for you already. So I was wondering whether in fact this is not actually more of a serious problem for utilitarianism than you gave it credit.
I was giving three possible responses to that problem. First of all, I was making the point that for the rule utilitarian, it isn't a problem at all, because they will just invoke a general rule of not enslaving people, so which in general is a good thing, so that would apply to this particular case. So if you're a rule utilitarian, you're quite happy with that. Secondly, I was invoking the universalizable nature of moral language, saying that it's something, sort of golden rule type argument, that if something applies in one situation to somebody else, then it has to be applied equally to you in another. And I agree that is slightly Kantian, yeah, but I don't think it's in any way in conflict with utilitarianism. I think these two philosophical systems, which are often opposed in some way, have significant similarities. And thirdly, I was saying that even if you don't accept either of those two, in practice, to actually specify in detail the situation where this particular scenario would be a problem isn't that easy. Right
now?
Tom, you said that you think that we should adopt utilitarianism because it enables us to make informed or have moral choices based on rational
thinking. Yeah.
And of course, the thought on which utilitarianism is based is induction. An action like this, I mean, Mill actually prided himself on the fact that it's inductive, because Hume thought that inductive thought wasn't rational at all, it's non-rational. Not irrational, but non-rational.
I don't quite see why I'm committed to basing anything on inductive thought.
Well, because the idea is that you see that lying doesn't produce the greatest happiness and the greatest number, so you choose not to lie. You think just here's an action that you might perform, it's a lie, and you think, well, every time in the past I've told a lie, it hasn't produced the greatest happiness and the greatest number. Therefore, it wouldn't produce the greatest happiness, the greatest harm this time, therefore I don't lie. of course, if you do think you've got a reason for an exception here, you actually basically utilitarianism is inductive.
Yeah, I think when you I would be more inclined to make my choices using, we have to make our choices somehow, but using throwing up my, general hypothesis of how one ought to act and basing individual cases on that. So more, yeah.
So you don't mind induction?
No, I don't think so.
Well, which is fine, but yeah. It's not rational.
I think there's two different senses of rational, to be honest. I think you're saying it's not indeed rational in the sense of deductive logic, and I might have to concede that. I'm not sure, but it is rational in the sense that it is relying on thought and argument rather than intuitions.
Eileen, you wanted to add something?
No, well, it's all right, let's clarify it. I would reject the view that induction is irrational.
I didn't say it's
irrational. No, it's non-rational. Well, we define what it means by rational.
Michael?
You know the 42-day rule the tension of suspects. What line do you think Mill might take on that?
Well, it would be the same balancing act, just the very same balancing act that government has to take now, really, to look at the consequences for the overall judicial system of imprisoning people without charge over a long period, which goes against all our traditional principles of justice, against the risk of letting someone go who could be seriously dangerous. And it's just that tricky balancing act which is at the very heart of utilitarianism, really. So what Mill himself would have said on that, and I really don't know, but it's he and we are in that, it's just... That is a very good question that just sort of gets at the very heart of the difficult moral questions where you have to assess one kind of consequence against another.
What about negative utilitarianism? You're sticking with rest happiness instead of the least of suffering.
Yeah.
Where do you stand on that?
On negative utilitarianism, yeah. meaning the absence of... How do you mean?
Making sure that your actions are designed to bring about the least suffering instead of the greatest happiness.
Yeah. I think that's probably quite a good way to look at it. I think certainly when you come to think about the case of animal welfare, that's a good... It's a good way to look at it, but often suffering isn't, as we understand it, isn't kind of quite the issue at stake. You know, if you take that last question about the 42-day thing, it doesn't seem quite right to see that in terms of suffering, but. I'm not sort of opposed to that. To that way of looking at it.
Which is suffering, least suffering, and the second rule.
Surely they're equivalent. Suffering is mine.
Not said anyway. So speak, Sam. We've got half a minute.
Right, go on then.
Well, I was going to say about the induction. Surely a utilitarian can be conjectural. You don't have to know sure what's going to go on, but you still have to make choice.
Yeah, I very much agree with that. Yes.
I'm afraid, in order to keep to this timetable and be fair to the other speakers, we must call a halt there. Our next speaker is Ben Basin, and he's going to give us a champion view. This time, I think, for
Tom to get us through utilitarianism so neatly in 20 minutes was pretty brilliant.